Hello, everyone. Welcome back to part two on smart cities. We are continuing our conversation about smart cities, and we're joined again with Dr. Nick Zangali and Dr. Sasha Dresdick and Molly Schnoke. So we are coming back into it. Last time we were kind of talking about the infrastructure and what's going on with smart cities. And now we're going to talk about, and I want to say we're going to be talking about smart cities first, pre-pandemic. So what are cities doing to become more smart? I'm using air quotes. Yeah. How can cities become more smart?
So one of the things that we have seen happening in smart cities, or cities that are working towards smart-related initiatives, smart and sensible-related initiatives, is a lot of attention being put towards collaboration and the collaborative types of approaches to this. And so what we've been experiencing, particularly in the Cleveland area, but the Metro Lab network in the United States is another example of this, is where universities seem to be teaming up with governments and private and nonprofit sectors in collaborative approaches to be able to conceptualize these smart city projects in a more comprehensive way, so that we're not just honing in on any kind of narrow aspect of this. So it's been really interesting for us through the Internet of Things Collaborative in Northeast Ohio, which is the collaboration between Case Western Reserve University and Cleveland State University, to become an integral part of the smart city activities that are happening within the Cleveland area, and be at the table with government and the public and the private sector as we begin to talk about the different projects that can take place and what these projects ought to mean for the city of Cleveland and where we might be heading.
I would add in terms of your questions, maybe a couple of examples from Croatia, and also my impressions about, I would say, sustainability of cities. I would say before pandemia, we had a sort of like very cyclical dynamics in cities, in terms that basically the cities were not preparing to any kind of crisis. They were in the process of ongoing activities and in a sort of like a booming machine, spending money on different kind of projects, and very often overborrowing, and especially overborrowing in terms of thinking that we always had economic cycles. So I had a feeling that the most of the cities are not ready to any kind of shock. And I would say this is a matter of resilience. The question is whether we have resilient cities. The question is whether any kind of government thinks about, in the good times, in terms of preparation to any kind of shock. For example, we just recently had an earthquake, very significant earthquake in our capital, Zagreb. And even though we knew there is a relatively high chance of earthquake, we were not ready. Why can I see that? I'm not like an expert in any kind of geology or whatsoever. But we had in Zagreb, we have many, many old buildings which are not suitable for the earthquakes, and they cannot hold earthquake. So what should be like the long-term strategy of the city? Of course, to rebuild or reconstruct these old buildings in a way that they can hold an earthquake. And we start thinking usually when it's over. So now we had earthquake, and now, of course, everybody is thinking we need to build better buildings and so on. But I guess it's late for many buildings, that the damage is done and so on. Because we can see that the buildings which are of recent construction, they're all fine. So this is very good example, I think, in global terms, that how like this kind of like strategic thinking, which is based on different kinds of analytics. So we're not speaking here only about different kind of fiscal, economic. We have to think about social phenomena. We have to think about different kind of seismic activity and other processes which might affect us. What will happen, for example, if the climate changes dramatically? What we see in data now that we have a spike, which is especially in Europe. I think this is the second hottest year from the beginning of the measurement of the temperature. So are we ready for drastic climate changes? I don't think so. So I think that with development of sort of like, I would say, effects of globalization, and I don't think this pandemic is a coincidence. I believe that we will have more and more these kind of extreme events, and cities and as well national government and supranational government have to be ready for these extreme events. We have to be resilient both on local, regional, national, and wider level.
So can I, before we jump in, I want to maybe frame it this way, although I don't know that this is entirely best way to frame it based on what Sasha was saying. You know, so there's this risk curve or the risk spectrum that we're talking about. But, you know, pre-pandemic, most of the smart city projects, I would say, were driven more conceptually about improving life quality. Parking, roads, mobility, lighting. What the pandemic has brought to life is a different conceptual framework. It now seems to be more about protecting or preserving life. So we've kind of shifted from the smart technology initiatives of how do we improve and make life better within cities to this kind of punctuated equilibrium that this COVID-19 has brought around to say, what are the types of things we can use technology for to preserve and protect life as it is, which kind of has this resiliency feel to it.
Right. I would add that we have to have both. For example, in construction, there is already technology which enables us to gather real-time data about quality of construction in a way that we can actually monitor damages on different kind of construction, whether these are roads, bridges, buildings. So with this kind of sensorics and with this kind of technology, we have the tools to basically affect quality of life immediately, and also tools to be able to plan our kind of sustainability and resilience plan for the future. So I think in terms of smartness, we need to broader our kind of perspective, not just from being, I would say, like smart, sensible, sustainable, but also to be resilient. So we can use the same technology to and apply it for all tools in a way, be able to implement different concepts.
So on that, we've seen the shift in what the government is focusing on. I agree with Nick that there has been, you know, this shift in talking about living in cities and stuff like that. Now that the pandemic has come, so where do you see smart cities going from here? You know, where do you see, you know, I think that with the pandemic, we've seen that there is a big gap in people who have and people who have not, especially with technology. I know here in Cleveland, when even Cleveland State, when we said we're going to go remote, you know, we had to say who doesn't have the internet. And we saw private companies stepping up and saying we'll give free internet for so long. But at what point, you know, is smart cities going to help out with the opportunity gap in that sense?
Well, and what happens in the short term, versus the immediate term of this, versus the longer term changes in things like planning and not being reactive, but proactive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I can start just with very, very shortly, you can actually hear in many occasions now that this kind of crisis actually shows some kind of real state of our affairs in many, many fields. So in the good times, we don't perceive and we don't see many things. Now in bad times, we see a lot of problems in governance, a lot of problems in terms of inadequate infrastructure, inadequate services. We see a problem of leadership. We see for example, which countries, which cities have better leaders, who reacted better. So we see much more than we see in the good times. And that's actually a very good sort of a guideline in terms of what we have to do. Like you said, the first problem, which is obvious, is that we don't have appropriate infrastructure. We have a problem of inequality. We have a so-called digital divide. So now I would say it's a good way. This is sort of like opportunity for, like, let's say, like a clean start to really improve our standards and both efficiency and effectiveness.
So I agree with Sasha here that, you know, some of the ills that we already have in the city or our shortcomings within the city, they become exasperated by these types of events. So we're seeing this already in the data that's coming back with COVID-19, for example, and in the minority populations, there seems to be, for whatever reason, a much higher death rate that's occurring from people who have become infected. And this points not just to technology, this points to a failure in our socioeconomic systems fundamentally, which I think is where Sasha was kind of going with this. But this idea of this pre and post, I think, is interesting to me in that whenever we have a disturbance occur within society, we have this kind of punctuated equilibrium that occurs, right? It's this node, and this node tends to shape or shift societal mood. And think about this, I like to think of moods in this way. We don't have a mood, moods have us, right? So we have a certain type of societal mood that's going on right now, this COVID-19 societal mood. And what that means is it's always residing in the background of everything that we're doing and everything we're thinking about, and it's shaping the present everydayness of conditions. And so what I think is occurring is, as we start to think about smart city projects, smart and sensible cities types of projects, that COVID-19 societal mood is whether we think about it consciously or subconsciously, shaping the types of projects and the types of things that we begin to focus on as we're starting to move forward. So all of a sudden, biometrics or the usage of drones, let's say, to deliver medical goods, that might have been a nice to have pre-March. Now all of a sudden it's a, hey, we should have type of thing, right? And so now investment and interest and technological development is moving in that direction, and it's moving in that direction because social mood or societal mood has allowed those things to become more relevant and seem to be of more importance to us given the conditions.
Well, and that could be true for surveillance too, right? I may want to know what my neighbor is doing and where they've been and how that affects me more directly now being exposed to them, but I may not want somebody knowing that about me. And so what level of tolerance do we have for accepting that? So I may change my thinking on to what degree I'm okay with surveillance of my children in school or myself and my colleagues at work, but is that temporary? Will there be a sort of psychological backlash to that at some point, right? Where I can accept it in a near term where there seems to be a more immediate threat, but how sustainable is that? Especially in a society that long term has not had a tolerance for any of that.
I also want to add, what is the point of no return, where we implement these things and you can't go back?
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of your questions, I would say that no matter what happens, we need to stay in the boundaries of ethical and moral thinking. So this is like the first step. The second, I would say, technology enables us to really customize solutions. So for example, I just read about that, I'm not sure who was, but there's some kind of new device software from MIT that is able actually to track proximity between mobile devices in a way that it doesn't identify who is the person, but identifies actually the sort of, it's tracking the movements and the social field of this person, and in a way that it can actually warn individuals who were in the proximity of infected individual without jeopardizing any kind of personal data. So there are different kinds of technological solutions that we can adopt and use in society without invading privacy. And I think we should go in that direction, because very often different kinds of governments are very happy to use some kind of oppressive measures of and tools of control which remain. There are a lot of books which are written in terms of war events, which are actually have this kind of topic of the sort of like declaring some kind of new normal, new state of affairs, where citizens should actually accept new standards. And I think that's very, very dangerous.
I will quote Yoda here. I'm channeling my inner Star Wars, right? I can't remember what episode it is, but Yoda says, something on the order of fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to the dark side, right? Something like
that. Episode one.
I have tons of stuff. I quoted that wrong.
No. It was episode one. That was that. That's what he was talking about. Yes.
The idea here is that we are in an anxious situation right now, right? And if we aren't careful, the anxiousness we're feeling right now, the fear we're feeling right now, could do exactly what you're saying, Kristen. It could lead us down a road in which we lose track with our fundamental principles of what it is that are important to us in a free society, or more fundamentally, what are important to us when we begin to conceptualize what it means to be human, right?
Right.
I do think we have to be really careful. I think policies driven out of fear is what we have to try to avoid as much as possible. Technology driven out of fear, I think, is another thing that we have to try to avoid as much as possible. And so we have to come up with mechanisms to temper that. The mechanisms that I think about a lot of times are these, the types of things that preserve us through ups and down times in society. So we have something that preserves us through ups and downs in society. And that in the United States is our constitution and our separation of the different forms of government, right? And that allows us to build in these checks and balances, although things move slow. One of the frustrations I'm having right now with smart city types of initiative is, and this goes back to even what I'm seeing with some of the funders. In fact, we're working with a group, NSF and Metro Lab right now, right? And they want a smart city project and they want an impact in 12 months. So my concern with that is what you're going to get is nothing more than a technological spill out or rollover without the level of thinking and principle formation that we need to have put in place that allow these technologies to fit in. We're so anxious to get an impact on what it is that we're doing, we're not conceptualizing the longer term or the broader types of outcomes or consequences that may come with this. It's much difficult to kind of build a symbiotic system in which it's working to the benefit of all than it is to just build something that is a technological experiment within the community. So my concern right now with the COVID-19 is it's rolling out all these kind of technological experiments using biometrics and other types of things. And that may occur in the short term, but as these things are rolling out, we can't lose sight of what Molly's been bringing up, and what you brought up is what might be the long-term impacts of this. At some point, if you want to ask me a question about artificial intelligence and where the things are heading with that, I have a real take on that and where things might be heading along those lines if we aren't careful.
But Nick, that also brings up the institutions and actors that are involved in this, right? And so you talked about universities and the perspective with which they bring, right? We talk a lot about in the United States, higher education, universities as anchor institutions in the communities in which they sit, right? And that is supposed to have meaning to the community, right? That we're not going anywhere, that we're invested, that we want is meaningful projects. You bring up a 12-month turnaround with NSF. So in a time period like we're in now with this pandemic, what are the types of institutions that should be involved in those decisions? Healthcare institutions, universities, who from the public sector? It's not just the vendor coming in. It's not a for-profit firm or somebody who's developed a sensor and say, hey, this can do this, right? Who's the set of actors that should be the decision makers of this?
I'm just referring to what Nick said. I completely agree, but I would say that the complexity which is going on in terms of pandemics, this is really a transdisciplinary problem. And in future, the solutions will not be easy. The question is, you know, we are now aware that the risks of new pandemics, of new kind of variety and type of virus, there are relatively high chances. Maybe we didn't see that before. But the question is here is, what is the trade-off between privacy and between the safety of individuals? And that's a big question, because we are all worried and we all care about privacy. But the question is, in terms of tolerance, I believe that the tolerance of all of us is now much, much wider, because we see the effects. So this will be very interesting in future to find this kind of, like, not only technological solutions, but legal and different other types of solutions, which are very comprehensive, in order to sort of like allow us to monitor individuals, but not to disturb, actually to minimize any kind of disturbance caused by that. It's not, I would say that's not straightforward. And in that sense, I would say, Molly, to reflect on you, I think academia has very important role. I would say fundamental, because now we're out of the sort of like the comfort zone. We need new solutions. So we all need to think out of the box. The standard solutions are not valid anymore. So, you know, academia has to provide solutions.
And I think that's one of the key institutions, right? So we talk in the in the Cleveland area, and Sasha and I, even internationally, have been talking about this concept of transdisciplinary approaches and what that means, transdisciplinary approaches. And the way that we conceive of that is that you reach a transdisciplinary approach when you leave your own discipline and begin to let yourself or go visiting in other disciplines. So you can begin to understand the languages and the meanings of what might be going on. And in doing so, new languages or new understandings begin to emerge. I really don't know of too many other places where that the ground is ripe for that than academia. Academia already has this multidisciplinary nature to it. We tend to separate ourselves into colleges and into programs, and to Sasha's point, he's right on. We have to rethink that completely. I think this is an opportunity for academia right now to not think from a college level, to not think from a program level. How do we think from a problem level, from a problem perspective, and then assemble the appropriate teams, develop the appropriate curriculums, develop the appropriate grant writing groups that cut across multiple disciplines that allow us to begin to attack a problem and an issue from multiple dimensions and to understand it more comprehensively. The struggle with that is it will mean slowing the process down. And that's the tension point we have right now is time. Because of the pandemic, because of the anxiousness of the crisis, this is what I was talking about. This kind of fear to react or fear to do something is impinging upon the appropriate processes that are needed so that we don't do something in the short term that could ultimately harm us in the long term because we haven't thought sufficiently through what it is that we're doing or what it is we're rolling out.
I think you guys make some really excellent points. And at this point, I really want to have final thoughts on smart cities and where we're going and where we might see ourselves, you know, either at the end of this pandemic or if you think that this is going to be, you know, almost like the new norm is working remotely. And especially if we're doing it now, seeing how it works and if this will be the new norm where everyone just works remotely.
Well, I would say that that actually this period, globally, we actually got time. When we are talking about smart cities, the government, the companies, NGOs, academia, we are all, like most of us, we are staying home, and we all have ability and time to think about how to reset our systems, how to cooperate and collaborate together. So I think instead of like waiting for the opening of economies, I think this period has to be on all levels, have to be used in order to sort of like to prepare, reorganize, reconceptualize for the new time. So I think this is a very good opportunity. And in that sense, I think it's very good to sort of conceptualize smart cities to be more efficient, more effective, but also more sustainable and resilient.
I would say I would answer it this way as well, is I think as we've been getting to is that we have these two different approaches to smart cities. We have this bottom-up approach that are project-based, opportunistic-based, and even external forces based, forcing activities because of the COVID-19. And I do think we need to keep pushing forward and moving forward on those types of projects as they arise and learn as much as we possibly can through transdisciplinary teams of what we can do and how we can possibly do that to the most efficient way ever, knowing that there's going to be fits and starts and there's going to be mistakes. At the same time, I would like to challenge people to think bigger about technology. And thinking bigger is by asking a bigger question. And that means I'd like people to think about what is most important to them. What do they want the future of life to look and feel like? And how can technology be utilized as a mechanism to get us there? Right? As we sit here right now, I want to be able to be closer to all of you. But yet technology only allows us to get so close. So my challenge to the technologists are, how can you make us feel closer given the situation that we have right now? Because my future life still wants me to be connected with people, be able to see people, touch people, smell people, do whatever it is we need to do to feel human, right? Zoom doesn't let me do that completely. It gets me close. So the challenge to technology is, how can you get me closer to that? Right? That's the type of questions that I would like people to be wrestling with. What do we want the future of life to look and feel like, and how can technology help us get there? And that to me is the process of smart cities. That's the conceptualization of smart and sensible cities.
All right. Well, thanks you guys so much. Thank you so much for joining us and being on this episode of the Levin podcast. This is been truly, truly enlightening. I'm so excited for what we'll see for the cities in the future. So thank you guys and stay safe.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Molly and Sasha.
Thank you very much.